good evening, everybody. So tonight, so tonight we are going to talk about any guesses? The great Sephardic Gaon. You were trying to think outside the box. He said the Chida, the Beit Yosef, very good. But we're going to go more. We're going to go back to contemporary times. We're going to talk about Rav Avadya Yosef. Rav Avadya Yosef is most known for what? What? It's photographic memory, probably. I mean, obviously, as far as Yabia Omer, but when you look at the Yabia Omer, you see, like, it's just ridiculous. I mean, there are entire paragraphs on gigantic pages that only quote names of Svarim, that are like, V'chein Kasav, so-and-so, V'chein Kasav, V'chein Kasav, V'chein Kasav, V'chein Kasav. The Israeli television did a documentary about his home a while ago, I mean, obviously a while ago when he was still alive, and they took you through his house, and like every wall is lined with Svarim. And his son or his daughter was saying, you see all these Svarim? He read and memorized all of them. Like there's not a single Sefer that he didn't read and memorize. So he was most known for that. I got an email from a Talmud of mine who said that his Rebbe, one of his Sephardic Rebbeim, is Rabbi Meir Gavriel Elbaz from Queens, is a Talmud of Rav David Yosef. Rav David Yosef is Rav Avadya's son. Rav Avadya has many sons, and they're all Talmid Chachamim. They all write a lot of beautiful Svarim also. So he said his Rebbe is a Talmud of Rav David Yosef. And I don't know, it's hard to believe this story, but and I've heard this story told about Rav Avadya since my days in yeshiva, but Rabbi Elbaz said that when Rav Avadya lived in Har Nof, after night seder in the yeshiva, Rav Avadya would come home and he'd call his son to come learn with him, because he wasn't done learning just because night seder was over, obviously, right? So he'd call his son to come learn with him. And Rav David would walk to his father's house and he'd learn with him late at night. And one time Rav David came in his house and his mother mentioned to him, you know, Mrs. Yosef mentioned to him that, you know, it's a weird thing. Every night, daddy, I don't think I called him daddy, but every night Abba comes home from yeshiva, and he wants to call you, and he always opens up the phone book, finds your number, and then calls you. And he looks up your phone number every single night. So Rav David asked his father, you know, Abba, why can't you remember my phone number? At that time, phone numbers in this country were 6 digits. It wasn't that hard to remember. I remember this, 5 digits, whatever it was. It wasn't that hard to remember phone numbers. I remember in the days when not everyone in Israel had a telephone, where you had to like wait years if you made Aliyah to get a telephone, or at least months to get a telephone. Can you imagine making Aliyah and not having a telephone? I mean, one of the reasons for Nefesh B'Nefesh success is that it became a lot better to make Aliyah. At least you have a telephone. At least you have, running water and things like that. So he said, why didn't you do it? So how come you can't remember my phone number? You remember every sefer that's ever been written. You write shuvos like Yabi Omer and Yechavadas, mostly for memory. And Rav Avadya said, it's very simple. I don't love your phone number. I love the Torah. And things that you love, that's what you remember. And this is often something that you hear from big Talmidei Chachamim who seem to have superhuman memories. We have the Zechus here in Kolon now. We had the Zechus of having Rav Shachter for all that time, and now we have the Zechus of Rav Yonasan Sacks visiting Kolon, two of my Rebbeim, who I'm so privileged to be able to call my Rebbeim, and both of them are astounding. I mean, they're just astounding what they know. And they both insist, or Rav Sacks certainly insists, that he's not a genius, that he doesn't have any extra intellectual abilities beyond everybody else, but he works really, really hard. He loves Torah enough to want to stay up till 2 in the morning every night, in order to keep on learning. It's interesting that if we talk about like the greatest Sephardic posek of the 20th century, so it's Rav Avadya Yosef. You talk about, very often people will say that mi Yosef ad Yosef lo kam ki Yosef, that from one Yosef to the next Yosef, another Yosef has not emerged. There hasn't been someone quite like him. So which Yosef are they referring to? So you both refer, yeah, from the Beit Yosef to the Chida, Yosef Zav Razulai, and from the Chida to Rav Avadya, lo kam ki Yosef. That apparently happens to be the most unquestioned, greatest Sephardic minds haven't all been named Yosef. Who is the posek for all of Ashkenazic Jewry on the page of Shulchan Aruch? The Rama. What's his name? Moshe Isselis. So it's fascinating. Mi Moshe ad Moshe lo kam ki Moshe. From the Rama, until Rav Moshe Feinstein, it's unclear if we ever had a single person that all of Ashkenazic Jewry looked to be their posik. So those names are so valuable. I think on the Ramaz Kever it says Mimosha ad Moshe lo kam kemosha, referring to the Rambam, right? That from the Rambam until the Ramah, there was never someone that great. But that's who Rav Avadya Yosef was. I gave a shiur about Rav Avadya once, and I said at that time that I don't know of any time that Rav Avadya actually met Rav Moshe. Like, I don't know if they ever actually met each other. Rav Avadya started coming to America every year in 1974, which would have given them ample opportunity to meet, right? Meaning, because Rav Moshe didn't die until 1986. I remember when Rav Moshe died, because it was Tainus Esther. It was like right around Purim time, and my school was supposed to have I was in like third grade or fourth grade, and my school was supposed to have a Purim thing, and I was all dressed up in my army uniform or whatever I was dressed up as, I don't remember, and we were all ready to go, and then we got a phone call that the Purim Masiva was cancelled because Rav Moshe Feinstein, the Gadol Hadar, just died. And I did not like Rav Moshe Feinstein very much at that time. I did not yet quite understand what the big deal was that we had lost Rav Moshe Feinstein. In the ensuing years, I got a better understanding of like why it was a big deal that we lost Rav Moshe Feinstein. But after I said that, I got like a million emails from people that of course they met, and there's even a picture in the Rav Moshe Feinstein art scroll biography of Rav Avadya Yosef meeting Rav Moshe, them talking to each other. People even suggested what the conversation might have been about, and Rav Avadya may have asked him for a bracha, and Rav Avadya probably kissed his hand, because that's what Sfardim do, right? The kissing of the hand. That's a big question when you're in the shul. You know, there's a halacha, the Rama says, that you're not allowed, but it's based on the shul, that you're not allowed to kiss, you're not allowed to give someone a kiss in shul, right? This is a big shayla that comes up at every single bar mitzvah, right? Bar mitzvah boy lanes, the father is so proud, his immediate instinct is to give his son a kiss on the head or something like that. So are you allowed to do that? Are you allowed to give your kid a kiss in the shul? Pashtus is, from the Ramah, is that you're not allowed to do that. So there's a whole discussion, but what if you're a Sephardic Chacham and you just got an Aliyah, and as you come down, you know, everyone wants to, you know, kiss the ring, everyone wants to, you know, wants to kiss your hand. Rav Avadya, even as a Tshuva Yechavadas, what if the women of the community also want an opportunity to express kavod for the chacham? Can they also kiss the chacham's hand? That the chacham is meeting everybody, giving brachos. Is it permissible for a chacham to allow women to kiss his hand? What would you think?
No.
That doesn't sound like it, right? Like, you'd be like, is that guy really a chacham? You know, like, you'd start asking questions probably if you saw that woman was kissing. So Rav Avadya discusses the possibility of a glove and how thick the glove would have to be. Like, you could imagine if you're wearing a hockey glove, you know, if a chacham is wearing a hockey glove and they kissed his hand. So first of all, that would be gross, because hockey gloves are gross. But he discusses that possibility in one of his shuvas. So they did apparently meet. There's a small paragraph in Rav Moshe's biography that Rav Avadya actually davened in MTJ, which is a chiddush also. MTJ is the yeshiva where Rav Moshe was the Rosh Yeshiva. I actually visited MTJ this year for the first time. At a meeting there or whatever. It's on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. And after Rav Moshe passed away, who took over as Rosh Yeshiva? Rav David. And after Rav David passed away, his son Rav Beryl took over as Rosh Yeshiva. There are people that have been learning in that yeshiva for like 40 years, meaning they have a job, they work or whatever, and they come and they learn in the afternoons or whatever. It doesn't strike me as a place that has a ton of like young bachrim coming to learn there, but they do have like an elementary school and they do have a high school. So Rav Avadya daven MTJ. Why is that surprising that Rav Avadya would daven shacharis at MTJ? It's not Sephardi, but what do you miss if it's not Sephardi? Birkat Kohanim. In Chutz Laaretz, there's no Birchas Kohanim. If you're davening in Ashkenazi Minyan, in a Sephardi Minyan, there's Birchas Kohanim. So it's a little surprising. Rav Avadya must have really valued meeting Rav Moshe, and it must have been the only way to fit his schedule, because he gave up on Birchas Kohanim. I know of a certain tremendous Talmud Chacham, Rabbi Yisrael Reisman, who I quote often, you've probably heard me quote him every night so far, said that that once a week he likes to daven in a Sephardi Minyan. Because why should he lose out on Birchas Kohanim? So once a week on Fridays, I suspect that he stays up all night Thursday night learning. He doesn't say that, but I suspect that's what he does. I know he has a mishmar in his shul that goes till well past midnight, and then he davens Vasikin with Sfardim on Friday morning. My suspicion is that there's not really any sleeping that goes on in between that every single week, but he does it in order to have the opportunity. My wife and I and a few other families went to a hotel a couple of weeks ago, and you know the closest minyan was a Chabad that was about 2.5 miles away. And it was a really hot day, so I was prepared to walk to the Chabad because that was the closest minyan. Turns out like 50 frum people came to the hotel, and one Sephardic family brought a Sefer Torah with them. So if a Sephardic family brings a Sefer Torah, they get to call the shots. So I got to have Birchat Kohanim even in Chutz La'aretz, even before I came to Eretz Yisrael. It was such a treat. Well, parenthetically, why don't we do Birchat Kohanim in Chutz La'aretz? Because of Tuma? And why does Sephardim do it? What does Birchas Kohanim have to do with Tumah?
You have to go to the mikveh before you go.
No, you have to go to the mikveh before you go on Har HaBayis. You don't have to go to the mikveh before you do Birchas Kohanim. Someone actually just asked me a shayla about a woman that needed to go on Har HaBayis for whatever reason. I wouldn't say needed, but really wanted to go on Har HaBayis, and that she has a problem with her ears that she can't dunk herself underwater. So is she allowed to go on Har HaBayis? And the simple answer is no. Meaning you can't go. And I mean, whether you can go on Har HaBayis even if you do go to the mikveh is a major discussion in Poskim. Agav, what do they tell you here? If you go on Har HaBayis? So what?
Went on Sunday, two kids.
Two kids went on Sunday?
What?
Har HaBayis, yeah. With the approval of the Kollel, or just like a...
No, it was the off Shabbos.
Oh, it was the off Shabbos, okay. So there's a big machlokas about it. Rabbi Tendler Zichrono Livracha, who happened to be Ramosha Feinstein's son-in-law, was Rosh Shiva NYU and was a world expert in medical ethics and was the chairman of the biology department at Yeshiva University, also my sister-in-law's grandfather. Rabbi Tendler used to go on Har HaBayis, and he used to pull off a couple of leaves from a tree on Har HaBayis every time he went. He said there's a mitzvah in the Torah of destroying any eitz, any trees that are eitz al Mizbech Hashem, that are near the Mizbeach. So he said, I'm getting a partial kiyma mitzvah by pulling some leaves off of a tree. And then whenever he was Masada Kiddushin at a wedding, he would announce that the ashes that he's using to put on the chassan's head, you know, the Gemara Masada Bava Basra says that, Yimashkechich Yerushalayim Tishkech Mini, so the Gemara says, we see from there that you put Efer Mikla Barosh Chassan, that you put ashes on the chassan's head, B'makom Tefillin. A lot of times maybe you don't see it, but it's usually being done. Like sometime either before the chassan walks down to the chuppah or right when they're singing Yimashkechich at the chuppah, they would put ashes on the chassan's makom Tefillin. So Rabbi Tendler would make a big deal of announcing that the ashes that I'm using are ashes from burnt leaves that I took from Har HaBayis in fulfillment of the mitzvah of destroying trees on Har HaBayis. And like, you know, half the crowd would be like, that's amazing, and half the crowd would roll their eyes because half the people believe that you can go on Har HaBayis and half the people believe you can't go on Har HaBayis. We asked Rav Shachter once what he thought about going on Har HaBayis, and he said that he thinks la halacha, if it was his halacha to paskin, he would say yes. But he says it's not his halacha to paskin, meaning you have to listen to the Gedolim of Eretz Yisrael. He said, I don't like when the Gedolim of Eretz Yisrael get involved in American Piskei Halacha when they don't know what's going on in the scene in America, so I'm not going to get involved in what's going on.
Yeah. Said that Rav Shachter had said that if you don't respect Rabbi Nuth, then who will?
Right.
So we have
to leave it to the Rabbi Nuth and Eretz Yisrael. Right. Rav Shachter believes very strongly that we shouldn't cut out the legs from underneath the Rabbi Nuth, meaning the Haredim don't respect the Rabbi Nuth, Chilonim obviously don't respect the Rabbi Nuth. It's got to be the Dati Lumi community that respects the Rabbi Nuth. So we have to build up the Rabbi Nuth because it's a very important thing. It's what keeps marriage is kosher and divorce is kosher and the yichus of Klal Yisrael. So we really need a powerful and strong Rabbanut and Geirus kosher and all those things. So Rav Shachter thought Meikar Adin, it should be permissible. Again, if you go to the mikveh first, then you know where you're allowed to go and where you're not allowed to go. He thought Meikar Adin would be mutter, but he also thought that it would be overstepping, that it's not his shaila to paskin. So he didn't. He always tells us not to go. But he said, if you hold that you're allowed to go, probably you must go. Meaning, it's not like, okay, I'll play it safe, might as well, you know, why should I bother anybody? I might as well not go. No, if you hold it, you're allowed to go. So what does it say to the outside world? If, you know, we're claiming that this mountain is so important to us and is the most holiest site in Judaism and is most, and then we refuse to visit it. So if you're not allowed to go, what can you do? There's nothing you can do. You're not allowed to go. But if you hold it, you're allowed to go, he thinks then you must go. Then you really ought to go, with, I guess, probably with some frequency, which is an interesting thing. There's a shaila, we're way off topic now, but I thought this was interesting. There's a shaila about going up to Har HaBayis because the halacha is, the Gemara says that any Amar Eretz has a din of a Tumas Zav, and a Tumas Zav is not allowed to go, someone who's a Zav is not allowed to go on Har HaBayis. Now Zav is a disease that we don't have anymore. So we're not actually Zavim. We don't actually have Ziva. It's a disease that simply doesn't exist. It involves some sort of fluid coming out of your body, but it's not urine, it's not semen, it's not any fluid that we know of, that it's not blood, it's not any fluid that we know of that comes out of your body. It's some other fluid that's a symbol of a disease, that's a symptom, I should say, of a disease. So we're not actually Zavim, but Chazal made a gezeira that anyone who's not Ma'aretz, Ma'aretz means someone who's not familiar with Tumen Tara, has the status of a Zav. So once they made a gezeira that we have the status of a Zav, we're not allowed to go on Har HaBayis because we're a Zavim. But you can go to the mikveh and not be a Zav anymore. So some of the poskim say, yeah, you can go to the mikveh and not be a Zav anymore, but if you go to the mikveh, you'll still be an Amaretz, meaning as soon as you emerge from the mikveh, you're back to being an Amaretz. And as soon as you're an Amaretz, Chazal goes there that you're a Zav. So there's no way to really, you know, get out of it. So that's a somewhat of a humorous suggestion that the post can have. If Rav Shachter would tell me to go, I would go. If he would tell me not to go, I won't go. So he said I shouldn't go because we have to respect the Rabbanan. Yeah, I would follow what Rav Shachter said, yeah. Not so hard to follow what Rav Shachter said. You know. I don't follow every single psak of Rav Shachter. Rav Shachter doesn't eat turkey, and he doesn't drink milk, and yet he has a lot of chumras. It's very, very hard to observe all of his chumras. We don't even know what his chumras are, because he's so clandestine about it. He's so, everything's under the radar. He does things in such a... What? He does not drink milk. Bichlal, he hasn't been milchig in 20 years. So, yeah, what's the 9 days like? I don't know. It's a little rough. Rabbi Rosner just asked me if I could ask the poskim here on Kolel whether he's allowed to make a siyum during Shiva, because he hates milchig. And he was planning on making a siyum so he could have a fleshig dinner one night this week, and now he's sitting Shiva. So can you make a siyum when you're sitting Shiva? So Rabbi Sadlovsky and Rabbi Sachs both said, no way, absolutely not. So I had to break him the bad news. Yeah, whatever. It's not the worst news here this week. So anyway, so Rav Vadya, actually, Rav Vadya visited Rav Moshe in MTJ. He davened with Rav Moshe in MTJ, and then he went over and he kissed Rav Moshe's hand, and he spoke with Rav Moshe in learning. On page 167 of the Art Scroll biography of Rav Vadya, of Rav Moshe Feinstein, there's a picture of them talking, and Rav Yitzchak Yosef is quoted in the Sefer Moshe Shapir Ka'amrit, that Rav Vadya said a brach of Shechalak Mechachmaso on Rav Moshe, and that Rav Moshe invited him to say a shir in MTJ, not as a visiting Rosh Yeshiva, because then there would be no end to all the visiting Rabbanim, but as the Bala Mechaber Yabiyah Omer. There's only one Bala Mechaber Yabiyah Omer. You know, Rav Moshe said, I can't just ask every Rosh Yeshiva who visits to say a shir, because there are a million Rosh Yeshiva. Like, just from YU alone, you'd have 30 shir. Like, it would be impossible if I asked every Rosh Yeshiva to say a shir. So, but instead, I'm going to say, the reason I'm asking you to say a shir is because you're the author of Yabiyah Omer. And there's only one author of Yabiyah Omer. It's such an astounding sefer. It's such a piece of such a masterful work that it's kedai to ask you to say a shir. Now it's interesting that Rav Vadya made the bracha of Shechalak Mechachmaso. What's the bracha of Shechalak Mechachmaso? When do you say that bracha? So the bracha Shechalak Mechachmaso liyareiv, that Hashem has given some of His chachma to those who fear Him. So you say that bracha when you see a massive Talmud Chacham. So it's a big question: when exactly? Like who? Who qualifies for Shechalak Mechachmaso liyareiv? So it's a big discussion. I remember when my son Yona was in Shalvim, in his, I think, Shana Aleph, maybe Shana Bet, I remember, I got a call from him. I'm with Ak, and we're going to Rav Chaim Kanievsky right now. What do I do? Do I say a bracha when I see Rav Chaim Kanievsky? So Pashtus, Yeah, meaning if not him, then who, right? Meaning if not Ruchaim Kanievsky, then there wouldn't be anybody to say the bracha on. So probably yes. But Rav Shechter told us that when he was in yeshiva, when he was in YU, he used to go away for, you know, all the boys would go away for the summer, and the summer was off. And then in Elul, when they'd come back to yeshiva, every single Elul, he'd say a bracha when he saw Rav Soloveitchik for the first time again. He would say a bracha shechal v'nechachmas alirei when he saw Rav Soloveitchik. So the way Rav Shechter said is, yeah, all of us said a bracha on Rav Soloveitchik when we came back. So I told that to Rav Twersky, Mayor Twersky, who's no longer here. I don't know why I'm pointing there. Maybe that's where America is. But I told Rav Twersky that Rav Shechter said that all the boys made a bracha on your grandfather, on Rav Soloveitchik. He said, what? There's no way my grandfather knew about that. He would have been very unhappy if he would have known that that someone was saying a bracha on him. I never heard another Talmud of the Rav say that they said a bracha on him, but Rav Shechter said that. He said, Rav Shechter told me when Rav Asher Weiss came to America that if I haven't seen him in a while, that I should say a bracha on Rav Asher Weiss. I mean, this is Nogei L'maisa, Gedolim trip tomorrow. Do we know yet where you're going? No information forthcoming. B'nai Brak, but isn't it split? Isn't there B'nai Brak and also Yerushalayim? Mm-hmm. But you don't know which rabbis.
I just told one of them is going
to Rav Asher Weiss. Okay. Yerushalayim will go to Rav Asher Weiss. He lives in Ramot. But B'nai Brak, I think Ak told me he wants to take the guys to all of Rav Chaim's kids to have them talk about Rav Chaim. I know all of Rav Chaim's kids. I don't know which time you have, but too few of Rav Chaim's children. Yeah. Oh, if you're going to see multiple gedolim in the same day, would you make more than one bracha? That's very interesting. Probably yes. If you don't see them together, probably yes. But the question, it's a big question whether there's really anyone that you're going to see or anyone in our generation that really deserves such a bracha. Most poskim say you do not say a bracha on just about anybody. Rav Chaim Kanievsky was an exception because he was Rav Chaim Kanievsky, but there is no Rav Chaim Kanievsky left, unfortunately, anymore. They say that Rav Elchanan once spoke in, Rav Elchanan Wasserman once spoke, was invited to give a shiur in Hildesheimer Seminary, where Rav Israel Hildesheimer founded, and he walked in, and all the boys were trained in advance, that as soon as Rav Elchanan walks in, that you stand up, and you make a bracha, baruch shachal, mechach masal ireya. So they all stood up, they said the bracha out loud, and Rav Elchanan fainted. And they woke him up, and he said, I think I just caused hundreds of people to say bracha levatala. So it was very uncomfortable for him. He wasn't happy about that. Now, obviously, Rav Vadia had great respect for many of the Ashkenazi Gedolim. There is actually, but especially for Moshe Feinstein. Rav Vadia has a shtick. Whenever he quotes like a Sefer, he puts the last name of the author in it. Meaning if the name of the author is in the Sefer, he'll put the last name in also. Like, Betzitz Eliezer was written by Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg. So he'll always quote, because of Betzitz Eliezer Waldenberg, you know, like he just like that. Because of the Igros Moshe Feinstein, you know, like he'll always, that's his thing. But he quotes Moshe all the time. He even quotes a Sefer, and this is a little disturbing. He quotes a Sefer called Ma'ane L'Igros 11 times in Yabia Omer. What's Ma'ane L'Igros? So, yeah, you know? Yeah, there was a whole Sefer that came out to refute Rav Moshe Feinstein's Pesachim, to argue on everything that he said, and to totally be mevazeh him. Like, every tshuva is written with such chutzpah in the Ma'ane L'Igros against Rav Moshe Feinstein. And not only that, they put it in the same typeset as the Igros Moshe. It was a Hasidish Talmud Chacham, someone who was very, very knowledgeable, and apparently he was hired by certain Satmar Hasidim to repudiate Rav Moshe, because they didn't like a lot of Rav Moshe's Pesachim. And in most yeshivas they ban it. You're not allowed to have it. Meaning it's like, this is how can you talk that way about Rav Moshe Feinstein? So Rav Vadia Yosef wouldn't allow it in the yeshiva, and when he quotes it, he doesn't quote any of the chutzpahdik parts, but he does quote it because Rav Vadia quotes everything, and that was his shita. That if there's something intelligent to draw from it, and the guy certainly knew a lot. You know, he certainly had a lot. So he'll quote it sometimes. But you know, Rav Avadia was known as a very big mekel, although that's a little bit unfair. Part of Rav Avadia's willingness to be mekel, to be lenient, is because he was trying to reach out to all Jews and make Torah accessible to as many Jews as possible. Meaning his whole founding of the Shas party was to be able to get as many Jews into yeshiva as possible, get as much government funding for yeshivas as possible. He really, and especially Sephardic Jewry in the middle part of the 20th century in Israel, was not what Sephardic Jewry is today. There was there were very, very few really sincerely from Sephardic Jews, and Rav Avadia really changed all that. He was a once in a many generations kind of leader. Really, Me Yosef Ad Yosef, Lo Kam Ki Yosef. Everyone held of, almost everyone held of Rav Avadia. And he'll quote everybody. He's unlike Rav Moshe. Rav Moshe, as we've mentioned a few times, will only quote like a Chasam Sofer, Nadav Yehuda, Rav Shlomo Kluger, Kiva Eger, and that's about it. You know, and the Rav Avadia quotes everybody who quoted his next door neighbors, upstairs neighbors, downstairs neighbors, anyone who wrote a Sefer. If he had my Sefer, he would quote it. It doesn't matter how much of an Amaretz you are. He'd quote anything. They say that Rav Avadia was, you know, he wore the sunglasses. You ever see the picture? He looked very cool. He wore sunglasses because his eyes were very sensitive to light. He had some sort of eye problem. It wasn't because he's like, yeah, I'm a boss. You know, that wasn't the reason he wore sunglasses. It was his eyes were very sensitive to light. So they said, he had a hard time seeing. When he would learn, he would go like this, like, you know, with a magnifying glass over the Gemara, and the story goes, I never asked Rav Shachter if it was true, that when he spoke in YU, Rav Shachter asked a question, and he said, I can't see who that is, but based on the sweetness of your voice, I'm guessing that it's the author of Eretz HaTzvi, that it's Hagon of Rav Shachter Shlita. That's the story that goes around. I don't know if it's actually true or not. I didn't ask Rav Shachter, nor do I know anyone who was there, but if this shir goes online, someone will email me and tell me that it's either bogus or that I was there and it's true. So I'll keep you posted if anyone says anything. It's so interesting. Like, you could tell the difference between Rav Avadia and Rav Moshe just by looking at the classic pictures of them. Anyone have a picture of Rav Moshe? Like, yeah, anyone ever see a picture of Rav Moshe? How's he always? You know, what's the famous picture of Rav Moshe? He's actually dressed very similar to how you're dressed right now. Right, famous.
A giant kippah,
the sefer. There's a beautiful picture of Rav Moshe in camp. He was in Camp Yeshiva in Staten Island or something, or somewhere up in the mountains. You see all these beautiful trees behind him, and he's wearing just a white shirt with tzitzis over his shirt, and he's thinking. He's got this giant kippah, and he's got a pen in his hand. And he's got pen and paper, and there aren't really any sefer, maybe one sefer, maybe a gemara in front of him. That was Rav Moshe, right? One sefer, and he's thinking, he's analyzing, and he's writing. He's always, always writing. Rav Avadia, the classic picture is, he's surrounded by sfarim. You know, mountains and mountains and piles of sfarim. You're like, is there a man under there? And then, like, you know, you can find Rav Avadia somewhere in between the mounds of sfarim. And it's like, these are the classic pictures, and it makes a lot of sense that these are, because that's who they were. That was their style. So Rav Avadia has many famous psakim, but before we even get to the famous psakim, he has many many important svarim. It's not only Yabbi Omer. Yabbi Omer was like his life's work. That was part of Tshuva Sefer. You read through Tshuva and Yabbi Omer, it will take you many many hours. It's a lot of pages. It's very very long. Yechaved Das is a much more manageable, and I would recommend that each of you try to learn a couple of tshuvas in Yechaved Das. My friend Rabbi Shai Shechter often says that he thinks high school halacha rabbein should teach halacha through Yechaved Das, because it doesn't just tell you dinim, it doesn't just tell you, like, bottom line what you do. That's very hard to learn. It sounds like just a bunch of rules. What Rav Avadia does in Yechaved Das is he starts with a shaila that someone asked, and then he goes through just basically, what do the psukim say? What does the Gemara say? What do the basic Rishonim say? How do we pass on the Shulchan Aruch? What do the Achronim say? And then at the end, we'll have Sikkum, he'll have a quick summary. It's, each tshuva is only a couple of pages long, and it's fantastic. It's so clear, so easy to read. So I would highly recommend that you familiarize yourself with... whether you're Ashkenazi or Sephardi, most of the stuff is known. You have to realize 99% of Judaism we agree on. You know, so there are some points of disagreement, but it's very, very worthwhile. And he'll often tell you what Ashkenazim do. He'll say, "Achenu b'nei Ashkenaz hayotzim biyad Rama," which is a play on words, right? Yosim biyad Rama is Reish Mem Hei, but Rama, that we follow the sheet of Rama. So Achenu b'nei Ashkenaz hayotzim biyad Rama do like this, but we, the Sephardim, do like Maran Beit Yosef. So it's a very, very worthwhile thing to try to do. Maybe before you leave Kollel, there are no svarim here. It's a real problem. They don't have, like, No, but you're not allowed to use them. You're not allowed to use any of the svarim. So I don't know. If you can get your hands on Yechav Adas, very, very worthwhile. But where did the Yechav Adas come from? Rav Avadia Yosef used to have a call-in radio show where people could call in and ask shailos. It was like Mike and the Mad Dog, except holy, right? It was like, I guess that's a little bit of a dated reference also.
Have recordings?
So there must be recordings somewhere. And they wrote the svarim Yechav Adas based on his radio show. So people would call him. So that was mamish on the spot, no research. People would call up, and he would like immediately like spit out the sugya with, you know, the Gemara, the Rishonim, the Achronim, and had a basin halacha. It is astounding. Obviously they edited it before they printed it, but still, it is absolutely astounding that he was able to do that. Yabia Omer is so unwieldy and difficult to read because he had time to work on it. And if you give him time to work on it, then he's just going to produce, you know. So I strongly recommend. But he had a number of very, very famous psakim. He had a famous psak about Hetter Mechira, and he held of Hetter Mechira, which is always a controversial issue around a Shemitah year. And always, whenever you hear someone say that this and this Gadol held of Hetter Mechira, that's always an oversimplification of the Gadol Shita. There's always more nuance in that, right? No one says that, oh, Hetter Mechira, that's ideal. That's exactly what we should do. No, it's always because of desperation and this and that. But, you know, at the end of the day, he held that Ethiopian Jews should be recognized as Jews and brought to Israel. That was a major discussion. Is it going to ruin the Yichus of Klal Yisrael? Can you trust that they're really Jewish? And he held that, yes, he has a long, long tshuva in Yabia Omer, where he tries to explain the Yichus issues, where he holds that Ethiopian Jews are brought to Israel. They should be brought to Israel and treated as Jews. He held that brain death is considered death, which might be in agreement with Rav Moshe, depending who you ask. There's a big discussion what Rav Moshe held about brain death. Rav Tendler held that Rav Moshe certainly held brain death as death. Rav Zalman Feinstein never said those words. He said cessation of breathing is death.
Didn't Rashi hold that not breathing was death?
Right. So the question is, nowadays that's a little hard to say. Because if you bury someone as soon as he stops breathing, you know, that's not nice. You're probably killing him. So you should probably try to hide him first before you bury him. It's a big discussion what exactly constitutes brain death. Moreno of Shechter Shlita thinks that it's a suffix death. A big nafkamina. If someone is brain dead, very often they're hooked up to a machine and their vital organs are still working, they're able to use those organs, the person is ever going to recover. Total brainstem death, no one has ever recovered from it. Every once in a while, there's a story on like the news of like someone had total brainstem death and they were about to pull the plug, and then the guy's like, "Hey, dude, what are you doing to me? I'm really here." And like, and he recovered, and whatever. You see a story like that. So I remember each time a story like that came out, we asked Rabbi Tendler, and he said, "Just because an idiot doctor doesn't know how to read a brain scan, it doesn't mean that brain death is not that." Meaning, not every doctor is qualified. So this was called the Harvard criteria. There are a lot of details about this, but it's a huge enough community because if a person is dead and they're brain dead. If you consider a brain dead person dead and their organs are still viable, their heart is still viable, their kidneys are still viable, their lungs are still viable, then you could use that to save other people. Because if they're dead, you're allowed to take their organs to save other people if there's someone else there that needs them. Most of the time, we don't do that, right? When a person dies, we don't take their organs. Why don't we take their organs when a person dies? So most of the organs aren't really, they're not usable anymore. Once the person dies, when a person really dies, when he's totally dead, not just brain death, when a person is really dead, the organs aren't usable. But if you hold brain death as death, you can have all these usable organs. And even though it's true, you're not supposed to be menavel lemeis, you're not supposed to rip apart a dead body, you're not supposed to pull things out of a dead body, but pikuach nefesh is docha every issur in the Torah, including that issur. Pikuach nefesh overrides. So if there's a chola there that needs a lung transplant, that needs a heart transplant, and you have a brain dead patient, and you hold that brain dead patient is dead, then you're allowed to take the heart and the lungs from that brain dead patient to save other patients. There was a very famous terror victim in Israel many years ago who was an organ donor, and I think there are like 11 people whose lives were saved by her organs. But if you hold that brain death is not death, then when you remove the heart of a patient who is not dead, what are you doing?
Murder.
You are actually murdering the person. So that's what Rabbi Tendler said. Rabbi Tendler used to say, "You want to disagree with me, that's fine. But if your father needs a heart, you better not take it from a brain dead patient, because then you're a murderer." So there are a lot of answers to that, why it is that people are willing to take but not to give. It's a very fascinating discussion. Rav Shach holds that a brain dead patient is suffix dead. And the reasoning is based on according to the Mishnayos and the Gemara, there are three vital organs. It happens to be that according to science there are more, but according to the Gemara and the Mishnayos, there are three vital organs in a person. Vital organ means without that organ you cannot live. There is the brain, the heart, and the liver. Now without those, you cannot live. So it's a question, how do we define death? When one of those organs ceases to function? When most of them cease to function? When they all cease to function? So Shach said that halacha has never had a clear answer on that. So he said the problem with saying that when one of them ceases to function, the patient is dead, is that the Gemara and the Mishnah never distinguishes between those three. The brain is the same as the heart, which is the same as the liver. As Rav Shach said, if someone is missing a liver, he could still be dancing at a chasana. So it's very hard to say that he's dead. Meaning, if you're going to say that a person that has no brain function is dead, someone with no liver function, he's going to die in a couple of days. But to say that he's dead now, because he has no liver, he could be dancing at a chasana. Yeah, you might have to come into the wedding hall with buckets of dirt and start burying him as he's dancing at the chasana. That's ridiculous, obviously. You can't do that. So that's this is a very, very, very broad oversimplification of like one of the most complex topics in halacha. But that is something Rav Vadya, who is a big person, held that brain death is death, and so the question whether Rav Moshe agreed with him. That Rav Vadya was matir many, many agunos. There were many MIA soldiers in the Israeli army, IDF soldiers that never made it back, and their wives didn't know if they were alive or not. And here you have a 21-year-old young Kala who doesn't know if she's allowed to get remarried because she doesn't know if her husband is alive. And Rav Vadya wrote many, many tshuvas to work on being matir agunos. He was instrumental in the 9/11 agunos. In 9/11, when Osama bin Laden attacked the Twin Towers, and there were people that went to work that morning and didn't come home, and there's no trace of their body. If you have a body, you know that the person's dead, but if there's no trace of their body, so how much evidence do you need to know that they're dead to allow their wives to get remarried? Rav Vadya was very involved. Rav Willig worked very closely with Rav Vadya on those issues. He was very important in that. In fact, there was one time where Rav Vadya had to get a surgery that was a very dangerous surgery. And it was a heart surgery, and he was concerned that he might die from the surgery. So he said, we have to delay the surgery by 3 hours, because he had to write a tshuva to be matir and aguna. He said, if I die on the table, no one else is going to be matir this aguna, no one else is going to be there to allow this woman to get remarried. So he delayed the surgery several hours in order to be able to work on, can you imagine, you're about to go into life-threatening heart surgery, and that's what you're thinking of, that there's a woman that needs your help who you never met before in your life, to try to make sure, see to it, that she can get remarried. So that was also a fantastic feature of Rav Vadya's tshuvas. Rav Vadya also, like many Sfaradim, answered wearing shetels. Ever notice a lot of Sfaradi women just wear like turbans on their head or things like that? He said, shetels are asr. Shetels look even more beautiful than a woman's hair. That's also erva. So he asked her wearing shetels. Not that she should go without her hair covered, but that she should put it also, probably saved Sephardic men a lot of money by not having to buy, $5,000 shetels for their wives. But he asked her wearing shetels. What? Three of them as well, yes. Many of them. He also allowed for Yibum in certain circumstances. He felt that we have to follow Sephardic tradition, and Sephardic tradition allows for Yibum. I was once talking to someone who met a person who was a child of a Yibum. What's Yibum?
You marry
your dead brother's wife, right? Your sister-in-law, right? The brother died without any children, so he married his wife. So we don't do Yibum anymore. We do instead Chalitza, because the Gemara says that if you do Yibum and you don't have perfect intentions, it's Shalol Lishma, it's like a Bias Nus. It's a very terrible thing. It switches from being a mitzvah to being an Aveira. So Rav Vadya, in certain circumstances, was Mekel for Yibum. So fascinating. Now, one topic that Rav Vadya wrote about that was, to you guys, probably so uncontroversial and so not at all something that would raise an eyebrow but was hugely controversial in the world of poskim because it was brand new, was the concept of making a bat mitzvah. No one had ever heard of that. Meaning in Europe, they didn't make bat mitzvah celebrations. They made bar mitzvah celebrations. Girls certainly became obligated to mitzvahs when they turned 12 years old. But there was no party, there was no siyum, there was no speaking. So this is the question. Can you have a bat mitzvah celebration? So Rav Vadya The logic for bar mitzvah, the chora, applies to bat mitzvah also. Why don't we make a celebration at a bar mitzvah? The kid's now going to be responsible to do everything, and he barely knows anything. Right? I mean, now he's chayiv in 365 los essays, 248 essays, and, you know, he could barely read Rashi script. Like, what do you want from the kid? It's going to be terrible for him. So why do we celebrate a bar mitzvah? Because today I am
a man.
No, you're not. You're a pipsqueak. Right? What does it mean? What's the whole idea? So the whole idea is based on the Gemara in Kiddushin. The Gemara in Kiddushin says, Gadol ha-mitzvah v'yosu, yosu m'misha eina mitzvah v'yosu. That if a person does mitzvahs that he's not commanded in, he gets schar for doing mitzvahs that you're not commanded in, but it's much greater to do mitzvahs that you are commanded in, which is counterintuitive. You would think it's better to do mitzvahs that you're not commanded in. But the Gemara says, no, Gadol ha-mitzvah v'yosu, yosu m'misha eina mitzvah v'yosu. So, therefore, he's about to do mitzvahs on a whole different level. Meaning the mitzvahs he did the day before, putting on tefillin the day before his bar mitzvah, which is also an interesting discussion, whether he should put on tefillin the day before his bar mitzvah. But Rav Shachter said that there are many Sfardim that put on tefillin years before their bar mitzvah. What he didn't say is that he himself put on tefillin years before his bar mitzvah also. But whatever mitzvah he did yesterday is here, and now he's doing a mitzvah that's up here. So it's worthy of celebration. Well, that same logic applies to girls also. A young lady, when she's 11 years, 11 months, and 29 days old, she does a mitzvah that's over here, but now she becomes a bat mitzvah, and it becomes a much greater mitzvah. Problem is, was never done. The Debrit Ziner, who, right, we discussed the Debrit Ziner, that was one of our Debrit Ziner. Can you, what do you think, in favor or against, based on what we said about the Debrit Ziner?
Awesome.
Very against, very against. Let's not think it's awesome. Yeah. So the Debrit Ziner was very against, and he said that there are no tshuvas before the 20th century about this, because no one ever did it. It wasn't even a habit. There was discussion why you don't say Baruch Shepatrani on a girl, right? Meaning the father is obligated for all the onshim that are magia to the child because of all the averus that he does before his bar mitzvah. So he says, the Baruch Shepatrani me'oncho shalzeh. As one said, bar mitzvah, the father said, Baruch Shepatrani me'oncho shalzeh. The kid turned to his father and said, good riddance to you also. Meaning, like, okay, so you're exempt from all my averos. So l'chora, that should apply to a girl also. And that's a different deos in poskim. Prima Gadim writes, that according to the Magen Avraham, the bracha is on the fact that the father no longer has an onesh for the sins of the son, because up until that age he was chayiv in the onesh. So maybe you shouldn't say it on a bat mitzvah. Why? Because the Magen Avraham says that maybe there's no chiyuv of chinuch for a daughter. It's a machlokas rishonim whether you have a chiyuv of chinuch on a daughter. So if you hold that there's no chiyuv of chinuch, then you were never obligated in the onshim of their averus anyways. So even when she was a little kid, you weren't obligated in her. The father wasn't going to have to pay the price. As opposed to, according to the Levush, that the bracha is about the fact that the child has reached gil mitzvot. It could be that the children of a person are punished because of the person's own averus. So meaning the way the Levush understands it is that it's not that the father's getting punished for the kid up until that point. It's that the kid gets punished for the father. Up until that point. So if that's the case, it could be that if a father does averos, so not only his sons get punished, his daughters get punished as well. In Rav Avadia, in Yabia Omer, Chelek Vav says that some of the Rishonim hold that there's a chiv to be mechanic, many Rishonim hold that there's a chiv to be mechanic, a daughter also, and therefore, according to both reasons, you should have to say a bracha, and therefore you should say a bracha of Baruch Shepatrani, says Rav Avadia, just not with Shema Malchus, because you don't want to risk a bracha levatala. However, many poskim hold, you don't say a bracha at all. Anyone, sisters, bat mitzvahs, remember if your father or mother said a Baruch Shepatrani? When would you say it? So there's no din that the Baruch Shepatrani has to be at the aliyah. Right? It's not a halacha that has to be at the time of the aliyah. It's just, that's when you know there's a minyan there. That's when he does something that's clearly overtly bar mitzvah-like, because he just got an aliyah. But it really could be at any time. Rav Moshe writes that Ikud Varm Shechniru Chacham Ba'ofen Asiyah Sheyivarech Chayiv Levarech Dafka Ba'asara Ubiyamakriya Ubishashakru LaTorah. That there are some things that they and I guess this is your point about when you would say that they institute that you should dafka say it at a time of Kriyas HaTorah, and it's only if you can't do it when the person is called to the Torah, so you do it after the Kriyas HaTorah by the Bima. And he says, even though it's got nothing to do with Baruch HaTorah. What other brach do we have like that? That you always do it together with Baruch HaTorah, even though it's got with Kriyas HaTorah, even though it's got nothing to do with Kriyas HaTorah. Hagomel, right? What does Hagomel have to do with Kriyas HaTorah? If a woman has to say Gomel, she doesn't need to get an aliyah. What do? You bring 10 men over and she says the bracha of Hagomel. When a woman gives birth, she should probably say a bracha of Hagomel. So what do? At the Shalom Zachar, if it's a boy, there will be 10 men in the house. She'll come into the room and she'll say Hagomel. So you need a minyan, but you don't need a Torah. So Rav Moshe holds that even though it's not really connected to Kriyas HaTorah, but since that's the minhag to say the bracha at the time of Kriyas HaTorah, that's why we don't say the bracha for her bat mitzvah, and that's why a woman does not say the bracha for her child either. So that's how Rav Moshe held. Rav Vadya's words, the Ber Moshe's words rather, are Al kolpanim nisbarra shemei olam lo shamanu v'lo reinu b'shum sefer kadmon v'achron. We never heard of anybody, no kadmon, no achron. Sheyasu suda shalabas kinechneses bebris haTorah uminag raze nilkach me hagoyim shesvivoseinu va'osakein over al yisham el chapatina keshachreim. What's he saying? That this evil minhag, what evil minhag is he talking about, the Ber Moshe? Bat mitzvah. Where did it come from? It came from egalitarianism, and that's a Gaisha concept. Judaism doesn't believe in egalitarianism. It's not a value in Judaism. Meaning there's no, what's the halachic term for egalitarianism? There's no halachic term for egalitarianism. It's not a halachic value. It's not a Torah value. It's not good or bad in the Torah. It just says sometimes women are exactly like men in halacha, sometimes they're not. But there's no like actual separate value called egalitarianism. It's just not a value in the Torah. So the Deborah Tziner absolutely rejected this. He thought that it was all chukas hagoyim. The Sri De'esh, ooh, someone suggested we should talk about Sri De'esh. Sri De'esh, says that it's a very emotional issue, and it's something that has to be dealt with based on pedagogically what's best for the young lady to be mechanich or for Torah mitzvos. And he says that this distinction that people make between sons and daughters when it comes to celebrating their reaching adulthood, pogas kasha beregesh ha'noshi shalabasa bogeras. It's really hurtful to the young lady that the brother, everyone made a big deal about it, and everyone had a big bar mitzvah, and they hired a fancy caterer, and they had the whole big thing. And for the daughter, it's like, oh, happy birthday. Here's a balloon. I'll give you a piece of jewelry or something. It's hurtful, he says. But he says, but you shouldn't do it in shul. Even not at night in shul when there's nobody there. You can make it in the social hall. You can make it in an individual house. And he says, but it has to be Torah dik. And bar mitzvahs also. You know what Moshe writes when he's asked about bas mitzvahs? He says, really, I would like to get rid of bar mitzvahs also. The way bar mitzvahs are celebrated, there's so little Torah value in bar mitzvahs. He said, if I had the koach to be able to get rid of bar mitzvahs, Moshe says, I would totally get rid of bar mitzvahs. Like it used to be that a bar mitzvah was that you'd lay and you'd make a seum on something, and now it's like, welcome to Josh's football bar mitzvah. Moshe's like, come on, what does that have to do with mitzvahs? It's not, so Sri Deish says it should be Torah-dik that the rabbi should darshan in front of the girl, and she should darshan, and he should talk to her about being Shomer Torah mitzvahs and Kashrus and Shabbos and all that. And he thinks that that there's a very good reason to do it. So the big support for bat mitzvah came from Rav Avadia Yosef. Rav Avadia Yosef in Rav Yomer Chelik Vav and in Yechavet Dat Chelik Beis says follow the logic. He even finds precedent in the Ben Ishchai that's saying to wear nice clothing on the day that she should get a nice dress because it's worthy of celebrating. He says the logic is Gadol Mitzvah V'Yoseh Yosef Mishayin Mitzvah V'Yoseh. So the logic dictates that you should have some sort of celebration just like a bar mitzvah. Deborah Tziner, nothing to him. It's taken from the Goyim. He says, if you're invited, you're not allowed to go. So the Sri De'esh, in his disagreement with the Deborah Tziner Rav, goes through all the sources of Chukos HaGoyim and why he doesn't think this is Chukos HaGoyim. Meaning, is that really Chukos HaGoyim? Just going to make a party when the daughter turns 12? Rav Moshe says, look, it's a birthday party, so you shouldn't do it in a shul. He says, Ki b'beis haKnesses, Ki b'beis haKnesses eino makom lasos tiver rishus. He says you shouldn't be making other celebrations in the shul, meaning in the shul proper, even if the Beis HaKnesses was built al Tanai. The Hatzeremonia shel Bas Mitzvah. What does ceremonia mean? The ceremony. I remember when I was in Kerem Yavne, the Rosh Yeshiva, at that time was Mordechai Greenberg, he's Israeli Rosh Yeshiva, so he had such trouble translating certain Hebrew words into English. He's like, Echum Nimanglit banana. Like, oh, it's a banana. Echum Nim psychologia. It's psychology. Okay. Meaning they're all English words. He was totally unfamiliar with the fact that they were all English words. It was a lot of fun. So Rav Moshe makes it, but Rav Moshe is unique because even when there is a modern Hebrew word for it, he won't quote it. Like, you read Rav Moshe's Tshuvas, and like, there's something about Aleph Yud Yud Reish. Next word, Kuf Vav Nun, Dalid Yud Shin Yud Nun Resh. And you're like, well, Aleph Yud Yud Resh, I know what that is. That's Iyar, right? So it's obviously the month of Iyar. But Iyar Kavan Du Shi Nir, what is that about? And then you realize he's talking about an air conditioner. If there's only a modern Hebrew word for it and there's no Lashon HaKodesh word for it, Rav Moshe just says it in English. That's one of his shticks that he does in his tshuvas. So he always says it in English. Some other question?
Yeah.
Oh, a few questions back there.
If the girl has a seal, can we do it in shul?
Can you do it in shul because it's Var Mitzvah? It's also a good question. Probably yes. If it becomes Var Mitzvah. It's a major shaila whether if a woman makes a seal during the 9 days, men eat meat at the seal. Right? So the shaila is, what is it about the seal during the 9 days that allows you to eat meat? Is it the fact that someone who's mitzvah in Talmud Torah has done that great mitzvah, in which case a woman is not mitzvah in Talmud Torah, or is it just the celebration of Torah itself? What would be the nafkamina aside from a girl?
A katan,
right? What if an 11-year-old makes a siyum mishnayis or something? So can you eat meat based on that? When my kids were little, and they were finishing siddur with mishnayis, they don't learn anymore, but when they were, I'm just joking, when they were little and they were finishing siddur with mishnayis, so very often have dinner, you know, they'd make their own siyum and they'd have a barbecue during the 9 days. That was just our own private siyum that we would have. But I once asked Rav Shechter about a woman making a siyum during the 9 days and whether other people can eat. I actually got the shaila from a close friend of mine who runs a girls' camp. And he says, I got a lot of siyumim, but it's all girls. So am I allowed to eat, and are all the girls allowed to eat? So I once asked Rav Shechter that shaila, and he said, Rabbi Warman wrote a tshuva about that. I'm like, okay, I didn't know that Rabbi Warman, like, I would never have known that Rabbi Warman wrote a tshuva about it. Rabbi Warman was a Rebbe in Hank High School. But he was an enormous, not but, and he was an enormous Talmud Chacham. It was a little bit unusual that he was a Rebbe in Hank. He wrote many, many Sfarim, an enormous, enormous Talmud Chacham. He used to always send his Sfarim to Rav Shechter. Rav Shechter loved Rabbi Warman. So he said, Rabbi Warman wrote a tshuva about that. So I found it online, looked up the tshuva from Rabbi Warman, and Taka, it was Rabbi Warman, Paschal, that it's mutter, that you're allowed to do. It's the only tshuva written on the topic, as far as I know. I later asked Rabbi Willard what he thought about it, and he said, Rabbi Warman wrote a tshuva about that. So it was, we followed that psak. We more recently asked Rav Shechter a question, and he said, no, there's a chiddush. He said something, he didn't call it a chiddush. He said, yeah, there's a svara like this. Look at Rabbi Warman's sefer. Rabbi Warman says the same thing. So among the Talmidim of Rav Shechter, someone put on our WhatsApp chat, like, does anyone know where this tshuva of Rav Warman is? So someone chased it down, and we found it was a tshuva Rav Warman wrote where the main chiddush he quoted from Hagon of Tzvi Shechter. So Rav Shechter, instead of just saying, yeah, I have a chiddush, that's what he says. Rabbi Warman has something in his sefer. I think he says whatever. Like, he wouldn't say that it was his chiddush. Rabbi Warman quotes Rav Shechter saying that chiddush. I'm trying to remember what the shaila was, but it was a fascinating shaila, but that Rav Shechter had some sort of chiddush about. He has another question? When he said what? Oh, because the halacha, strictly speaking, when you're in a kedushas beis haknesses, demands that a person not eat in a beis haknesses, that a person not, meaning including Candyman and whatever, that a person not speak sichas chulin in a beis haknesses, meaning not just during davening, not just like during psukim zimra or chazaras shatz at all, meaning like going over to the rabbi and making small talk after davening or your friend after davening. When you have DNA beis haknesses dictate that you're not allowed to do even that. So we assume, right? Also, that b'shas tefillah, it says. But so why do we all speak sichas chulin in the beis haknesses? So the heter is that we assume that batei knesses shebechutz la'aretz are al tanai hein asuyin, that they're built al tanai, that there shouldn't be full kedusha to the shuls. So Rav Moshe is saying that even though none of our shuls have the maximum level of kedusha that you could have, and it's a big question in poskim of like how do you measure that and how do you like thread that needle of having some kedusha based knesset but not all of it, and do we really get to choose how much kedusha based knesset creates? Right, it's a little bit difficult, but anyway, that's what Rav Moshe meant by that.
I'm pretty sure the Avi Yosef says that right now. Last night I was in like a Scorpius knesset.
At all. Yeah, so maybe they started maybe more marketed about that. Rav Moshe revisits the issue again in a later tshuva, and he allows a kiddush in shul like you would make for any simcha, and even allows a rabbi to keep previously scheduled bas mitzvah on schedule. I mean, he says you don't have to go canceling bas mitzvahs just because you first read my tshuva now after it's already on the shul calendar, so you don't have to go canceling it. But Rav Avadia thinks that there's no chiluk between boys and girls. He says the chiluk doesn't seem to be based on anything between boys and girls when it comes to bar bas mitzvah. And Rav Avadia writes, "Ein dvarav mechuvarim la'alacha." I don't think it's correct. Meaning, there's a thing that people do in yeshivas a lot of times, that they're talking and learning, and one person says, oh, but there's a logical reason why there should be a difference. Not every logical reason necessarily makes a difference. You then have to research and see if there are any sources. Like, you need to bring sources. Rav Shachter would often tell us, the way to tell the difference between Talmud Chacham and somebody's not a Talmud Chacham is that a Talmud Chacham will quote sources. Someone who's not a Talmud Chacham, which is a smart guy, will give you all sorts of logic, which may be right, may be wrong, but you're not going to know unless there are sources. So you could see from if a person, so Rav Avadia says, I don't see any sources to be mechalish. Hari ikra davar tali kishenasa mitzuva v'yosef. The whole thing is about you becoming mitzuva. So memela hu adin lepas shigia lemitzvos. V'lechein ha ikra kumosha k'savnu l'el shegam l'nara bat mitzvah yesh makom la'asot sudat simcha v'odah l'Hashem yitbarach. So he said, certainly a girl becomes a bat mitzvah. I don't see why you wouldn't make a big celebration about it. So that's it's interesting. Rav Willig has an interesting sheet on it. In your experience, by show of hands, how many of you have sisters? Okay. And all of you are bar mitzvah, right? So how many of your sisters' bat mitzvahs were not quite as big as your bar mitzvah? Right, okay, a lot, right? So where did that minhag come from? That we do it, they'll have a bat mitzvah. So with my daughter, we told her it's because of corona, so we had it in the backyard or whatever. I don't know what we would have done if it was not corona, but a school has very strict rules about it. So we do it, but we tend to have a practice to do it, you know, more toned down than a bar mitzvah. So Rav Willig thinks that there's a halachic basis for that. Rav Willig thinks that the bar mitzvah is a chiyuv on the father for completing his chiyuv to be melamed b'no Torah. That he has to start, the Rambam says, but the very next line the Rambam says, but a father has to teach his son Torah. And if you've done that, so you're being mesayim that chiyuv. So that's why we make a su'uda for a chasna, mila, pidna, ben. We celebrate the father fulfilling his obligation, because Masechta Kedushin says a father has to find a wife for his son, and a father has to. So all of those things. But there's also an inyan on the child to have simcha because of Gadol Mitzvah V'Yosef. So says Rav Willig, the part of Gadol Mitzvah V'Yosef applies equally to a girl. The part about fulfilling your chiyuv of teaching Torah to your daughter does not apply to a girl. So whereas by a boy it might be a celebration of two mitzvos, by a girl it's a celebration of one inyan of the Gadol Mitzvah V'Yosef. And therefore, halachically, it makes sense that one is going to be a little more elaborate than the other. So he thinks that there's halachic basis for it. Okay, we'll stop there, and I haven't yet figured out what the last two are.